Hey, my friends. Welcome back to another episode of Notes from the Edge. I'm your host, Lisa Lacey, and this is the place we have the conversations we should have been having all along. This is where we talk about the things that you're not talking about, but we're going to talk about them. And today's guest is Mark Astor, who is an attorney, a former prosecutor, and partner at Astor and Simovich Law, where he leads a legal team that is focused on helping families experiencing crisis involving addiction, severe mental illness, psychiatric instability, medical complexity, and resistance to care. After witnessing the limitations in the criminal justice system in addressing untreated mental illness and substance use, he dedicated his career, this is so needed, Mark, to helping families find lawful, compassionate alternatives before irreversible harm occurs. His work includes emergency guardianship, involuntary treatment proceedings, recovery planning, and navigating Florida laws such as the Baker Act and Marchman Act, and we'll talk about those. And he regularly works alongside families, clinical professionals, treatment providers, and medical teams to create coordinated paths towards safety, as well as what's most important, which is long-term stability. His commitment is very personal, and his central belief is that behind every diagnosis, arrest, psychiatric hold, or involuntary commitment is a real human being just trying to survive and their families trying desperately to hold on to them. Mark, welcome to Notes from the Edge. How are you today, my friend?
I am good, and thank you so much for having me as a guest. It's so nice to meet you. I know we've been emailing, but now I get to see you face to face, and I'm glad to be here. Thank you.
Yeah, I'm so glad to have you. And I'm so glad to be talking about this work today because I am one of those people. I'm a former psychiatric patient. My new memoir, Notes from a Certified Madwoman, is a look at the psychiatric arena from the patient's perspective. And in my opinion, we need more humanity in the system and we need more dignity in the system. And there's a lot of reform that can take place with people like you and I. Just having these conversations alone can help. Guys, if you haven't, if you're on LinkedIn, check out Mark's LinkedIn. He did a lovely video a few hours ago talking about the need for families to have support when they are involved in the care of somebody having mental health crises or addiction crises. So definitely check out that video. It was really important for families to have support too. And there's just not enough of it out there. Well, Mark, families are often told their loved ones must want help or reach that rock bottom before anything can change. From your experience and from everything that you've seen and witnessed, why can waiting until somebody's ready become dangerous or sometimes even deadly?
Yeah, I love this question. I'm so happy that we're starting with this one, Lisa. So, part of the problem that I encounter, and I've spoken to at this point thousands of families over the years, is that sometimes families will say, "Well, I don't understand why can they not make the decision to save themselves, to go into treatment, to stay in treatment, to take their medications, those types of things, right? All the things that we would normally associate with a behavioral health issue." And I think that question revolves around the concept that when somebody has a behavioral health issue, that it's a conscious choice and not a disease. And I think that the overwhelming volume of science these days confirms that it is a disease of the mind. And if you can appreciate that and accept that, then we can have a conversation about, well, how do we treat it if it's a disease? Because if it's a disease, it's not a conscious choice. And I tell families it's as if their, your loved one's mind had been kidnapped, right? It looks like them, sounds like them, walks like them, but it is not the proverbial duck. That's all, what's running the show. Their disease is running the show. And once you can accept that, then you can say, okay, if they're not able to make the decision to save themselves, who can? What are the options? And so the conversation with families is about talking about the various options that are available to help somebody who's got a behavioral health issue. One of those obviously is getting the state involved, which is probably not a good idea, but I can certainly walk you down that path, and we could talk about what that looks like. But in terms of rock bottom, it's not about your loved one hitting rock bottom, because their rock bottom might mean they're dead. And I don't mean to be blunt, but I don't sugarcoat this stuff. I'm always going to be honest with people, and I hope they know that I always come from a place of love. But coming from a place of love means you have to be honest with people. So it's not about them hitting rock bottom. It's about the family mate hitting rock bottom, right? When have the parents had enough? When are they sick and tired of this, of being sick and tired? When are they tired of the chaos? When are they tired of the nightmare of dealing with somebody who either won't go to treatment, won't stay in treatment, won't take their medications, is getting arrested, is getting sucked into the mental health system, is having overdoses, you know, seems to be unable to function, right? Can't hold down a job, flunks out of college, hanging out with people they would never normally hang out with. Their eating habits are, you know, completely changed. They're not bathing. I mean, all the things that families are used to seeing. So if we're going to change that, then somebody has to make that commitment. And where I come in is helping families to make that commitment. That's when they contact us, when the family has hit rock bottom and they're done and they're ready for a different outcome.
I love that. I love that you pointed out it's not a conscious choice, and it's certainly not a moral failing
by anybody, your loved one. I mean, this is not somebody's fault. And sometimes, as you know, Lisa, there's a real sort of stigma. There's a sort of guilt associated. Well, you know, and you sometimes have the parents, right? Well, your father was an alcoholic, and that's why he drinks too much. Or your mother had schizophrenia, that's why he has schizophrenia. And they, you know, sometimes the family say, well, it's the blame game.
The blame game. Got to be somebody's fault, right?
Yeah. Even if that is true, right? And there is evidence to suggest there's a strong genetic component to this. That doesn't mean to say that we need to blame somebody, right? The conversation has to circle around, how do we move forward? What does moving forward look like?
And what I love is you're focused on the family as a unit, because it affects everybody. And that's what I had posted a comment on your video, that I thought it was a beautiful recommendation, that when your loved one who is struggling goes into a treatment facility or a recovery center, ask if they have a family program. And you know what? Every recovery center should have and needs a family program.
Yeah, that is such an important point. The quality treatment centers have a family program, because it's so important for the family to do the work when their loved one's in treatment. Because if they don't, right, what happens is, you know, a year from now, their loved one is over here and the family is still over here. And now we have a problem, right, bringing everybody together. And what families don't realize most of the time is that they have been traumatized, right? There's a reason they call it a family disease. It's because it slowly destroys the family unit. It's why mom and dad are having issues. It's why the siblings have all moved out, right? It's like a metastasizing cancer. It slowly destroys the family unit. And so we got to work together, get everybody back together so we can save the family. And a good program will have that exactly. A good treatment center will have a family program. And I would encourage families that when they're looking for a facility to ask that question, do you have a family program and what does it consist of?
And dual diagnosis centers too. When I went into inpatient rehab, I went into a dual diagnosis center. What that means, my friends, is they focus on mental health and the addiction component, not just one or the other. And that was pivotal for putting me on the trajectory for long-term stability.
Yeah, I will tell you, Lisa, you know, when I first started doing this work back in 2016, you know, there weren't a lot of dual diagnosis facilities, as you point out. These days, I think we only work with a true dual diagnosis facility. There's only a handful of them that I work with anyway, but they've got to be able to handle a primary mental health case because of the nature of the cases that we're seeing now.
Yeah. Yeah. There is typically a mental component to addiction, at least from what I've lived and seen and experienced in being in the rooms for so long. So you argue, Mark, that legal intervention, when handled correctly, can be an act of love rather than punishment or control. So what's the difference? What separates compassion from coercion? And How do you protect, again, dignity and the rights of the client?
Yeah, so look, when it comes to getting somebody into treatment, saving them, there's a couple of options, right? Number one, you could do nothing, right? And as like any disease, it's progressive and it can lead to catastrophic consequences. Number two, you can hope the state steps in. How does the state step in? Well, either through the criminal justice system, because people get arrested, or the mental health system. Here in Florida, we have the Baker Act, but every state has a version of the Baker Act. I file about 300 cases a year to get people out of Florida's mental health system that shouldn't be there. And I can tell you, having spent almost 20 years as a prosecutor and defense attorney in the criminal justice system, and also spending the last 10 working in the behavioral health space and encountering the state on many occasions, the state does not take care of people with behavioral health issues. So you don't want the state stepping in, because once they do, they are effectively terminating your ability to make decisions for your loved one. And they're also terminating your loved one's ability to make their own decisions and determine where they go to treatment. So the whole idea of what we do is to empower the family, so the family can now step in and start making the decision that their loved one simply can't make, right? Yeah. So there's that component. Now, in terms of protecting rights, and I certainly appreciate that we need to, on these cases that we're handling, the court is appointing a lawyer to represent them. They're not going in there blind, So typically the court is going to make sure that rights are protected. And, when I was a prosecutor, one of the responsibilities of a prosecutor is not just to seek the conviction, but to make sure the defendant actually gets a fair trial, or the case is going to probably get reversed. And so I'm very aware of the fact we need to make sure people's rights are protected, but we also need to balance that with the idea that we're trying to save them. Yeah. So we're going to make sure they get due process and they get the lawyer. The court's going to give them that. We're going to make sure they have a fair hearing. But at the end of the day, what we're really talking about is trying to save their life. And if you understand that, and I understand the discomfort sometimes with families who don't want to basically be standing on the other side of the courtroom to a loved one. But if you understand, it's not really your loved one, it looks like them, right? The whole proverbial duck, and we're trying to save them. Then I think that with that mindset shift, you can appreciate the fact that this has to be done, because if it doesn't, either there's going to be a catastrophic consequence or the state's going to step in and make a complete mess of things, and things
it's
are just
not getting better. Yeah, it's not going to get better. No, it's the spiral will continue, and there will be dire consequences. So the earlier, the better. And I love the way that you put it. Look, families, when you're done, that may be when it's time, right? When you're done.
Yeah.
And instead of cutting them off and the tough love and doing that, find somebody like Mark to guide you through this process. Now, Mark, I don't think there's a lot of you out there.
There isn't. I was the first.
Talk to me about that.
Well, there are other people trying to do what we do. I don't think they have the skill set we have. You have to understand that the civil arena of behavioral health and the criminal arena, which can include behavioral health, all work together, right? And when you understand that, that's when you can get a good outcome. So I've got some competition, and I'm okay with that, except when they steal stuff off my website. I'm okay with that because I can't help everybody. Yeah, I've had to file 3 trademarks in the last year to protect my intellectual property, but okay.
I feel you there, my friend.
You can't have an original thought, okay. But yeah, my wife and I built the first law firm in the country to do this work, and only this work. And as a result, I will tell you that most of our clients, moms and dads, are not in Florida. They're all over the country, the whole.
Okay, that was going to be my next question. If people want to reach out to you and they're somewhere other than Florida.
Yeah, typically they do call us from other than Florida. So, the Northeast Corridor, but I've had calls from California and Oregon and Hawaii, and I've had a couple of international clients. And, a lot of the time they say, well, why would I call a Florida lawyer? Well, there's a couple of reasons you want a Florida lawyer. Number one, we have the statutes on the books that enable us to get a family the authority, the ability to save the loved one and get them into treatment. That's number one. Number two, we have really great treatment. And I probably work with 3, occasionally a 4th treatment center here. That's true dual diagnosis. They can handle a primary mental illness case. They know how to handle a situation where there's a lot of trauma, and they have a good family program. And so there's 2 very good reasons to come to Florida. And so the idea is, we want to get somebody to Florida, and there's a myriad of ways to do that. but we get them to Florida. If we can keep them here for 3 to 6 months, then they can go back to their home state. Now they're stabilized, right? Mm-hmm. They're working that recovery journey. And hopefully that they have the skill set now they can go into treatment in their home state if that's where they choose to go. And we don't have to worry about them running out of treatment, stopping their meds, you know, going back to the crazy life they were living. So a lot of time we want to get people here just to get them stabilized and get them, you know, onto that road to recovery. So a lot of people are coming here for those reasons. And, you know, I'm pretty good at getting them here. So
I love that. You highlighted three really important things when it comes to the work people will be doing, and that's mental health, trauma, and family work too. Pivotal.
Yeah.
Pivotal to do all of that at the same time, in addition to the addiction component of it, because they all intermingle and they're all intertwined. So yeah, guys, go to Florida. There are some top-notch facilities in Florida.
There really are. And when it comes to sort of the whole mental illness substance use, sometimes it's chicken or egg. And, you know, I did a video a couple of weeks ago where, you know, a family said to me, well, what came first, the mental illness or the drugs? And I said, does it make a difference?
I was just going to say the same thing. Does it matter? Yeah. Does it matter? You got it. You got it.
Chicken or an egg. That's what I know.
I got a chicken and an egg. Well, what do the families that you work with, do you feel misunderstand the most about addiction or mental illness, especially when the cognitive impairment prevents their loved one from making the choices, conscious choices, or even recognizing the seriousness of where they're headed? What do you think they misunderstand the most?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, as we talked, Lisa, that the whole idea that it's a conscious decision, but one of the things I do see a lot of, right, and I sit down with parents, sometimes they're together and sometimes they're not. And you have sort of this, like this butting of heads, right? One parent says, look, I'm done with this. They're out the house. They're homeless. I don't care. The other parent's saying, no, that's not the answer, right? You know, we need to continue to support them. And I've had families who, you know, went out, bought their loved one a car, you know, in the hope of sort of coercing them to change their behavior. And then they got them an apartment again in an attempt to try and, coerce them to change their behavior. And I said, well, how did that work out? Well, you know, we got him this and we got him that. He didn't change. He said he would, but he didn't. And then I've had parents say, you know, they've called me. They're like, well, he's on the streets. Well, how's that working out? Not good. So you've got sort of two extremes. You've got the enabler and the one who says, no, I'm done. Get him out of the house. And my response to that is, well, okay, neither one of those gets us to where we need to be, which is treatment, right?
Yeah.
Buying a kid a Lexus in a condo or renting him an apartment doesn't get him out,
right?
Or have him couch surfing, that doesn't get him into treatment either, right? What gets him into treatment is you making the commitment of time, energy, and resources and committing to making the decision he cannot make, which is to go to treatment and stay there long enough in a clinically appropriate facility, take his medications and follow whatever the treatment protocol needs to be. And if we need to get some extraordinary authority to make sure they take their medications, then we get it. If we need to get a different kind of authority so that we can control finances so they don't use it for nefarious purposes, or just simply so we can pay the rent, make the car payment, pay the electricity bill so they don't get evicted, right? Then we need to get that authority. And again, it really depends on what the family, what they need. How much control do you really need? So we can certainly tailor that, but we have to come together and get rid of the idea that it's either one extreme or the other. No, the answer is to get them into treatment, and it needs the family to make that decision, or consequences can be severe, or the state's going to step in, which we don't want. Because if you're in the criminal justice system or the mental health system, chances are they're not going to get better. They're simply not. And so we want the parents, the family, to be in the driver's seat here. But somebody has to make that decision and make that commitment that we're going to do this. So that's sort of the dichotomy I see. And sometimes, Lisa, families call us year after year after year, and they simply cannot make that decision. And I think it's because they're sort of hoping against hope that that their loved one is one day going to wake up and have this, you know, miraculous awakening.
Mm-hmm.
And my thought on that is that it only happens in the movies.
Yeah.
It doesn't happen in real life. Now, does that mean that every individual who ever experienced recovery had to have a lawyer force them into treatment? No. We're not appropriate for every case. But there are a lot of people out there who are very far down the proverbial rabbit hole who cannot make the decision to save themselves. And if you want to pull them out, and the longer you wait, the harder it is to get them out, then we have to have a conversation about making that decision.
Because once again, it is not getting better. It is not getting better. It will continue to get exponentially worse. That's just it. That is the bottom line. That is the absolute truth. What did you say that I wanted to circle back with that I thought was so important? Oh, the end goal, my friends, is the word stability, stabilization, enough so that the mind can clear enough to start making those conscious choices. Because at some point in mental health crisis and addiction, you are on autopilot, right? You as the client, as the patient, are no longer in the driver's seat. So somebody needs to be in the driver's seat or the car is going to crash. Yeah.
Yeah. And you know, they call it the miracle of recovery. Lisa, one of the things I've been really fortunate of, I would even say blessed, is that over the years, I've got so many close friends who are in recovery and are in the now work in the behavioral health space. Some of them went back, got a master's, got a doctoral degree in some type of behavioral health field. And there's a couple of things that I've noticed. One is they all have this unbelievable story. You say, how is this person even here? Right. Mm-hmm. The stories that you hear, the craziness, you say, how did they overcome that? Okay. That's number one. Number two, even if they've been in recovery 5 years, 10 years, 15 years, even longer, they work on their recovery on a daily, weekly, monthly, yearly basis. They're constantly working on their recovery. They're always doing something. I mean, I have a good friend of mine. He's my closest guy friend at this point. He's the best clinician I've ever worked with. So he's also become my brother from another mother. And I will tell you, I can tell you for a fact, he goes to a meeting every single week. He's been in recovery now, I don't know, 20 years. He goes to a meeting every single week. He sponsors other guys. And so he works on his recovery. He does what he needs to do so that he doesn't, you know, fall back, right?
It's always whispering and always right around the corner. Both my husband are celebrating 8 years of recovery together. Oh. We met when we were just 30 days clean. We did 13 step our way into a healthy marriage. I do not recommend, folks. There is a reason they say stay single, because we brought a lot of baggage into our relationship. However, miraculously, we have made it. But he works on his stuff, I work on my stuff, and we meet in the middle. And it is daily practice. It is a daily practice. No matter if you're in Celebrate Recovery, AA, Smart Recovery, whatever system you're using, whether it's a transformational coach, whomever you're working with, have a team. You gotta have a team under you. I have my holistic psychiatrist. We use meds when we have to. We use supplements when we can. I've got my personal coach. I've got my business coach. I've got a therapist. Guys, I have a team still 8 years in that supports me and has my back should another crisis hit. But see, now we're all educated, so we know what to look for, right? We know the signs. My family will be like, Lisa, you might be entering a little mania. And I'll be like, oh, no, no. And then they'll be like, no, we need to sit down and talk about this. Cause I'm like, no, it's not happening. But we've all been educated and we all work together as a team. My daughter included, my mother, God love her, her and I, we don't even get along, but still she has my back when it comes to this particular issue. So it is a family learning how to work together to support the client, support the patient, and everybody needs to have everybody's back because it's traumatic for everybody. And you've highlighted that many times just in the 20 minutes that we've been on here, because you've seen it so much. And I don't think families are given enough tools at all to mediate this. And it breaks my heart that you hear from some families year after year cycling the same thing, hoping for a different outcome when the rock bottom is always inevitable. But yes, as a recovering addict and as somebody who has recovered from a full-blown mental health psychosis into long-term stability, those things are always whispering my name. So I manage it, you know? You manage it for the rest of your life, and it's beautiful.
Yeah, you bring up a really good point here, Lisa, which is that families are trying to get information, right? They're trying to find out, what can I do, right? And there's so much misinformation out there. I mean, so much garbage out there. It's unbelievable. And I think one of the things that's been really important to me personally is to try and get information out to folks. So obviously, I love sharing my story on with you. But I have 1200 videos on YouTube, and it covering all of the issues that you could possibly ever think of. And somehow every day I seem to come up with two or three new issues that I see. So this, I give away a lot of content. I just wrote a book about Florida's Marchman Act, which is an amazing, unique statute here in Florida that allows us to get somebody picked up off the streets and into treatment for 90 days. There's nothing else like that anywhere in the state. It's for primary substance use disorders. I wrote a book about it, and, you can download the book for free. So
I love that. We'll make sure everybody has the link. Yeah.
So absolutely. I think, you know, one of the problems I've encountered is there's so much misinformation out there, partly because, you know, it's the internet and people just put all kinds of stuff out there and they have no idea what they're talking about. So I really, for folks out there that want information based on real cases, because look, you don't need to be a lawyer to go read the Marchman Act or the Baker Act, or even do a little research on guardianship. You can do that yourself. I mean, I don't know how accurate it'll be, but you can get a basic 10,000 foot overview of how this stuff works. But if you wanna know how it works in the real world, then that's a conversation I wanna have with you, because not only is it, how does it work in the real world? How does it work in Miami-Dade compared to Broward or Palm Beach or Pasco or Pinellas or Leon? Is there a difference? Would I file a Marchman Act case in one county but not in another? And if so, why? Right? The answer is yeah, there are some counties I won't file certain cases in because I know they don't do a good job, right? For a myriad of reasons. But unless you understand that, right, then people are just blind. Oh, yeah, you know, we can take care of that. Okay, good luck with that. It's not going to happen. I know that county. I filed cases there. It's a disaster. Right. But that just comes from experience and knowing what things work and what things don't work in certain, you know, different parts of the state. And what happens if they get arrested in the middle of this? What happens if they get Baker Acted in the middle of this, which can happen? I've had cases where we filed the Marchman Act and a guardianship together, which gives max control. And then in the middle of this, the person had a psychotic break and got Baker Acted. Now we're in three different courtrooms, three different judges. How do these things work? How do we navigate this so we can keep this person on the right path? How do we do that? Well, I mean, you have to understand how all this stuff works together. And you have to have experience handling these different types of, you know, legal causes of action. And if you don't, and respectfully to my colleagues that are stealing my stuff off my website, they don't. And then they call me to come fix the problem. So, right, because they took on, you know, the case went sideways and they don't handle that stuff. Or somebody got arrested. They don't know how the criminal justice system was. They've never handled a criminal case. So giving families information based on just, you know, 32 years of practicing law in these different arenas and handling all these cases, for me, is just a way to give back. And if you want to have a conversation about how we can move forward, you know, with some type of cause of action, then great. I have, you know, four amazing people in their intake department, and you can call them and have a free conversation with them about how we can help you. So
I love that. Mark, what do you think the biggest piece of misinformation out there is?
Okay, I see two. The number one issue is families saying, oh, treatment doesn't work. Treatment doesn't work. Okay, that's number one. Number two, oh, I tried that legal thing. That doesn't work either. Okay, well, we have to have a conversation about that, because when someone says their treatment doesn't work, what do they mean by that? Mm. Right? Because a lot of time we'll speak to families and they'll say, well, he's been in and out of a dozen treatment centers. She's been in and out of a dozen treatment centers. Well, okay, let's talk about that. First of all, how long were they there for? Mm-hmm. And was it clinically appropriate? Mm-hmm. Because if you send someone a treatment for 30 days or even less and they bounce, and over and over and over again, then yeah, that treatment didn't work, right? They have to stay long enough in a clinically appropriate facility and follow the protocol that is required. So how do we do that? How do we do that with somebody who can't make the decision to save themselves? Well, that's where we come in, right? I'm going to get you the authority coming from a place of love where you can make the decision they cannot make, okay? So that addresses potentially the issue of treatment. Then they say, well, that Marchman Act thing doesn't work, or guardianship doesn't work, or I read a whole thing about Britney Spears and I don't want to go down that road. Okay, let's have that conversation too, because I can tell you we've had tremendous success with some of the work that we've done. But it's just the beginning of the journey. It's the catalyst. Getting you the authority to make the decision your loved one cannot make is the beginning of the road to recovery, right? It's not a magic wand. And if it is a magic wand, you're probably not going to start seeing the results for 3, mm-hmm. 6 months, maybe even a little bit longer. So it doesn't happen like that. The other issue is, and I've seen people try to, file their own cases, which, I mean, look, you could represent yourself in a murder case if you want, right? I wouldn't recommend it, but What makes the legal aspect of this work is its accountability and its enforceability. Meaning, if your loved one does not comply or walks out of treatment, I have somebody I can go to and say, Your Honor, you ordered this person into treatment and they left. Your Honor, you appointed the parents as the co-guardians so they could start making decisions for this person, one of which is that they go to treatment. And they didn't comply with the wishes of the guardian. Can we have some relief? Okay. So the family has somebody that can do something about this that they can turn to. Also, their loved one knows they have been told by the court, if you don't do what I've ordered you to do, then we're going to be having a very different conversation about where you're going to be eating your three squares a day. And it won't be in treatment potentially. So there's accountability.
Yeah.
That's what makes this work. Okay.
And you also highlighted something important. Clinically appropriate. Is that the wording you used? Clinically appropriate? Yes, that matters. Because if the treatment didn't work, that means it didn't work. That means it wasn't the right kind, or it wasn't, to your point, long enough to stabilize into being able to make healthy, conscious choices for yourself. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, look, this, it takes time. I mean, I know from experience, it's probably a year long journey.
A year. Yeah. At least.
It's a year, right? It's a year. And I'm going to tell you.
Get your brain clear. Yeah.
To get your body to physically heal, your mind to physically heal, right? And you have to develop the skill set. You know, so my good friend, Dr. Robert Sanchez, I think I mentioned him, not by name, but he's just an absolutely world-class clinician. If anybody's watching this and they want to talk to him, I'll be glad to connect you with him. You know, I was speaking at a conference with him, and one of the statistics that he laid out that I thought was fascinating was the fact that if you can keep somebody in recovery for a year, they have a 70% chance of maintaining recovery for the rest of their life. If you can get them to 5 years, it's 83%. So you can see the biggest jump is in that first year, right? That's the most important time, that very first year. After that, things get progressively better, but the first year is the key to all of this. Right, which means you have to keep them in treatment long enough. You may not need me for a year, or I may be there but not actively working on the case. I'm in the background if you need me, right? But it's a year-long journey, and some families say a whole year. Yeah, you've been dealing with this for 10 years. So what difference does another year make? And in that year, I need you to work that family program so that you can also heal, because whether you know it or not, you've been traumatized. And here's one question I ask every single family that I've ever spoken to. When was the last time you had a good night's sleep? And you know what they tell me? They don't remember.
I don't remember.
They don't remember the last time they had a nightmare because they're so worried and stressed, and they're worried that that phone call is going to come, that something tragic happened, or they got arrested, or there was an overdose, or whatever it was. So we have to get them there, but it takes time, Lisa. It just does. I mean, that's the reality of the situation. It's going to take time. So, you know, sometimes I get families call me and they say, well, I just want to put them in treatment for 30 days and they'll be good. No. Mm-mm. No. First of all, that's not going to work. And second of all, I'm not going to take your money or accept your case if that's your goal. And if somebody's told you that 30 days is enough, then they lied to you. They just flat out lied to you. And
it took 6 months after my psychosis for my face and my eyes to start looking normal. 6 months after my psychosis for me to start looking like me again in my eyes. 6 months just to start looking normal. It takes 5 years for your brain to actually start healing from long-term addiction. 5 years for your brain to start getting to a place where it's actually starting to heal itself, at least from alcoholism. So yes, it is a long journey, and you're right. Families need the trauma work too, because they have been traumatized. And man, if they can just jump on it for that year too and work on themselves during that year, eventually working on yourself becomes awesome. It's actually a really good time. It's not terrible, folks. And the thing is I spent 20 years running from all of this into a bottle, only to realize, wow, when I turn and face these feelings and face this trauma and face what has happened and face what I've done, it's not terrible. It actually creates freedom eventually. But a year is just the start also, because then it is lifelong management.
Yeah, it really is. You got to do this. I mean, I tell people, you know, it's got to become a habit, right? I mean, mm-hmm. I just know, I mean, I'll be 60 in January, and I just know if I don't get to the gym 4 days a week and eat pretty healthy most of the time, I just
start. Oh, it's all downhill. It goes fast.
It is from the neck.
You hit 45 and it goes fast, and then I hit menopause, and I was like,
You know, it's like, I just know 4 days a week, you know, Monday, Tuesday, you know, Thursday and Saturday, I'm going to the gym for 45 minutes. That's just part of what I do. And if I'm traveling,
built into your life. Yeah.
It has to be. It has to be. I have to do those things. Otherwise, it just, everything falls apart. And frankly, mentally, I just start to not feel so good. So it has that effect too. So people
have to work. The work is so worth it, though. It is so absolutely worth it. My husband and I, and by the way, he spent a year in a lockdown facility rehab, year in lieu of jail. That was his choice. Says two choices: jail or a lockdown rehabilitation facility for a full year. But we have memories that we get to keep, and they're joyous, and they're pleasant, and they're fun, and they're playful, and it is so worth the work now that's just automatically built into the lives that we will have to just manage differently than maybe some other people for as long as we're here, you know? And I suffer from a congenital blood disease too, which could technically, it's very life-threatening, take me at any moment. And here's the thing, I have memories now I get to keep, because when it's all said and done, and if I have the luxury of just fading away, it is not going to be the house, the car, the things, any of that that I'm worried about. It's going to be the people I love, the people I was connected with, my memories and my regrets. And I don't want my regrets to be memories I missed out on or can't remember because I'm too jacked up, right? It's so worth it. The journey is so worth it.
You're amazing.
Well, thank you.
You're a ray of sunshine. Your husband must be proud of you.
We are proud of each other, and we tell each other that daily. We are very, very, very proud of each other, and we are each other's accountability partners too. You know, who knows? I don't know. I don't know if we didn't have one another as our accountability partners. And you know, the first 2 years we were in meetings 2 days a week for 2 years straight. Two days a week, You know, he also married somebody fresh out of a mental institution. So that's on him. Every now and then he'll be like, can you stabilize a little bit? I'm like, oh, you knew what you were getting into here. You knew what you were getting into. So yes, it is so worth it, my friends. But I was not capable. I didn't think anything was wrong. When I went into inpatient rehabilitation, I went in thinking, well, I might have a bad marriage and a slight drinking problem, and came out with a chart this thick, right? Because I didn't think it was that bad, right? We don't think it's that bad. So you're absolutely right to help the families step in to save the lives of their loved ones, because it will always only get worse. And it starts to stack on itself too. The worst gets worse, gets worse, gets worse. Towards the end there, I was out the door and 4 hours twice in a row was already in jail. 4 hours. That's all it took for me to find trouble. So it was getting exponentially worse, and it's always going to. So you're absolutely right to help families when they call, say now's the time. Now's the time. There's never an early enough time.
But one other thing I would say to families that are watching this and are going to be listening to this is there's no shame. Okay. Sometimes, especially like, for instance, I get calls from the Orthodox Jewish community. They're a very close-knit community, and there's sort of this shame that it should be discussed outside of the community. I've worked with families that have transgender children, right? And again, there's this sort of shame of what, we shouldn't talk about this because it reflects badly on us. First of all, when you call us, it's a confidential conversation, right? Whether you hire us or not, it's a confidential conversation. The second thing is that there's no shame in this. Mm. Okay. There's no
shame. And no blame. No blame, no shame. Take those two things out of the equation and everybody can get the help they need.
Exactly. I will tell you, if something tragic happens, you'll feel guilty that you didn't do something.
Mm.
You will. Yeah. And I've had that happen, right? Where we try to do a good job of keeping in touch with people. You know, and I have my, we've called people, 6 months, a year after they called us and didn't do anything. And if we make 10 phone calls, at least one of those families are going to tell me they lost somebody. And that is not a fun conversation to have with the family, but the guilt that they express, it's heartbreaking. So, yeah. There's the old saying, right? Be guilty, be sorry for what you did do, not what you didn't do.
Mm. Yeah. Yeah. And ask for help when you feel like it's above your pay grade, and know that it's above your pay grade, actually, So get support that you need. Know that it is absolutely above your pay grade at a certain point. And yes, in my lived experience, some of why I didn't get help earlier was that my family didn't want it to be their fault, right? They didn't want the things that I struggled with to be their fault. So take the shame, take the blame out of it, and recovery can be so much fun. It really can. And when you find that ease and grace and frictionless, freedom-filled life, you turn around and you look and you go, wow, that was worth it. And your loved one's going to turn around and go, hey, thank you. Thank you for saving my life when I couldn't.
And they do.
That's what they're going to get.
When they come back, they do.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, it's so moving. So you have seen families move from hopelessness, we don't know what to do, we're done, and chaos to clarity and action. When a situation appears medically, emotionally, or legally impossible, what do you tell families about there is a way forward? How do you address that when they're stuck in that utter, complete chaos and hopelessness?
Yeah, I sometimes I refer to myself as the ghost of Christmas future, right? As I go, as opposed to the ghost of Christmas past. And I think it really is about, having what we call it triaging the case, right? So, I mean, you speak to our intake people, and it's about having a conversation with them about, what's been going on, how long has it been going on for, what have you tried, what's worked, what hasn't worked, all of these things, and then coming up with, with some options. So I think that's an important part of what we do, is really figuring out what does the family want, what are their goals, and then saying, okay, sounds like what we have to offer can help you. Do you want to talk about what that looks like in practical terms? What you can expect in the next 90 days, 6 months, a year, right? And
What are your options, right? You offer options into a situation that feels utterly, completely hopeless. That is hope. You
it
offer
is,
hope.
and I will tell you, Lisa, sometimes there's a different option other than hiring us. I mean, I'm a big fan of interventions. My friend Dr. Robert Sanchez is a world-class interventionist. So there are times where an intervention is a wonderful, gentle way to get somebody into treatment, and then we come along and make sure they stay. Right? We don't always need the hammer. We can be sort of, the backup, right? So we use an intervention to get them into treatment or get them to Florida, and then we come along and make sure there's a safety net for the family and some accountability for their loved one, so that once we get them into treatment, we make sure that they stay long enough,
Yeah, to
right?
get the
So
stability.
yeah, so sometimes we will work with a clinician like Dr. Sanchez, right? And bring that person in. They can help us to find the right facility for your loved one, because these days our cases are very complicated. Since COVID and the legalization of marijuana here in Florida and 39 other states, we're in the middle of a mental health crisis all over the country. So finding those people the right resources is key and critical. So it's not always, well, you need us, this is the only option. It's not always the only option. And sometimes there's a better option, or there's two options, and then we can have a conversation about how do we use both of them, maybe at different, points in time. And so again, that really just comes down to, having the experience of handling these cases. I mean, I've had families call me and they say, I want to file for guardianship, but here's the rub. He's sitting in the county jail. He's been charged, with some type of crime. Okay, I can help you with the guardianship, but we need to address this criminal case, because if that's not handled right, correctly, they're not going to be around for you to file for guardianship, because right now the state has him in the criminal justice system. Let's bring in a criminal lawyer, right? I mean, like I said, I spend a lot of time in the criminal justice system. I don't handle those cases anymore. I bring in a lawyer who does criminal work, but who specializes in and understands what the goal is here.
I
So,
love that. And what I
right.
love about what you're talking about is in all that you do, it's the right fit. What is the right fit for this family, for this client? That is so pivotal. It's not, here's what we do, throw it down. It's,
Take it or
if
leave
we're
it.
not the right fit, we'll let you know what is the right fit. It's
Right.
beautiful.
I'm not going to sell you a pickup truck if you want a convertible. You know what I mean? And if you tell me that you want a tank, I don't sell those. I mean, you get the idea, right? I mean, and sometimes, look, even when a family calls us, we still have to have our legal hat on, right? I need to know that if we're going to take this case, that we have a very good chance that we can get a successful outcome, right? Because as a lawyer, I'm guided by rules of professional responsibility, rules of evidence, rules of substantive law, and rules of procedure. I need to make sure that we can file a case and have a great chance to win it. Otherwise, what's the point in taking it? Sometimes Lisa or family will call us and say, I want to file this, or I want to file that. Okay, when was the last time you spoke to him? Well, it's been several months. He's been on the street. Well, how do you know he's using? Well, he must be. Okay, I don't, I just, when a family, when a mom says to me, I just know, I'm sure she's right. Moms have this amazing ESP thing,
Intuition,
but
yeah.
I got to know I can prove the case. I need something that where I'm going to go into court and the judge and say, Mr. Astor, give me evidence that they're actually using right now, if it's a drug, substance use type case. Well, Judge, I don't know. I mean, the mother says, you know, she hasn't seen him in 4 months. Well, I'm sure she's right, Mr. Astor, but you as a lawyer, you're guided by the rules of evidence.
Law, you need evidence.
I don't have any evidence that's in front of me as the judge to make a decision that's going to help you. So part of the case, part of the triage process is, do we have sufficient evidence, right? Can we prove the case?
Yeah.
And again, that just comes from trying. I mean, I was prosecutor. I tried over 200 jury trials in 5 years. That's a ridiculous amount. And I've tried everything, you know, petty theft to capital murder. So again, having that experience and not having to guess whether or not we can win the case is part and parcel of doing the right thing. And also making sure that the motives are right. Every once in a while, I get a client that calls us that unfortunately is using this as a sword and not a shield. Doesn't happen very often, but occasionally I get one that tries to slip one past the goal, you know, past the goalie into the goal without me seeing it. And that's all I'm here. I'm not here to hurt anybody, right?
Yeah.
So we got to be careful. And if it turns out that we can't prove the case, okay, is there another option? Maybe we could do an intervention, right? Maybe there's a different way to accomplish the goal here. But it all comes down to having that conversation, which means, yeah, you're going to have to pick up the phone and have a conversation with my team, right? Or at the very least, go to YouTube and start watching the videos, or go to our website and download the book about the Marchman Act, right? Yeah. I've also got one about the Baker Act, too. Start doing a little bit of research, start doing some homework, a little due diligence. And if you can go find your loved one or figure out where they are and find out what's happening, that's great, too.
Right? Well, friends, make all of that available. You don't have to go search for it. All the links that he's talking about will be available in this video. What I love about the work that you're doing is it's so individualized to each human and human family, because that's what it's about. We are human beings, right? And so I love that the work that you do with each case is so individualized. That takes time, that takes effort, that takes empathy, and that takes compassion. Thank you for what you're doing. And I was wondering, because I thought it was so rare, if you were one of the few that are doing this type of work, and to hear that you are the first, and now people are trying, but not quite reaching the goal, does not surprise me at all. Where were you 10 years ago, my friend? I needed you.
You know where I was? I was sitting in a library, flat broke, opening up my own law firm. That's where I was.
And look at you now.
Started out of the library with no money.
Hey, guys, comeback stories are the real deal. Seriously. Actually, yeah. I want you back on. I want to talk about that comeback story, because let's talk about comeback stories in here. So let's get you on next month. And I want to know how you went from that library with nothing to where you are now, saving the lives that you're saving, not only of the clients and the patients, but the whole entire family systems. So it's beautiful work, my friend. Thank you for the work that you're doing. All right. We close out with our guests with two questions. You ready for them?
Let's go.
All right. The first question is, in your own life, what did you perform in order to survive? And what did dropping that role, mask, or performance do to better your life?
So, you know, after I left the state attorney's office in 1999, I did some private defense work, made a lot more money, got married at 34, divorced at 35. I was completely miserable. So for me, it's been a long journey to figure my life out. So here's what happened. I met somebody that basically changed the direction of my life. And, this is somebody that owns a company that teaches lawyers the business side of practicing law, right? Which is not something they teach any law student at any law school anywhere in the country.
Which makes no sense. But anyway.
I know. Right.
Yeah.
Which is why the idea that most lawyers are making tons of money is simply not true. Most of them are struggling, which is why I put a couple of lawyers into treatment too. But that's a different conversation for a different day. I've also represented some lawyers and a judge or two. So it's interesting work, to say the least. So when I went to work for this company and this individual, what I didn't realize was that they were a personal growth company for lawyers. And I realized two very important things, Lisa. Number one, the reason that I had nothing really to show for my life and all the skills I developed was because I'd failed to take 100% responsibility for my life, both professionally and personally, which is why you know, 10 and a half years ago in February 16, I was sitting in a library flat broke. So I had to take 100% responsibility. The other important piece that I learned from working for this individual, a mentor, was that I had to find a group of people that I could help. So when I was as a prosecutor, even though it didn't pay very well, in fact, the first 2 years at law school, I was living at home with my parents. But I always felt like when I went to work, especially when I was, you know, prosecuting violent felony offenders, or if there was a, you know, the victim, of, you know, a family of a decedent, if it was a murder case, that I always felt good about what I was doing, always, because I prepared very hard. If I was going to trial, especially on a serious felony, I wanted to go in there and win. And I won a lot of my cases, but it wasn't because I was a brilliant lawyer. It was because I was always prepared. And so I needed to get that feeling back, right? But so I had close family members and friends who had these issues. And I went online, and there was nobody that built a law firm doing just this. There was a couple other lawyers who were dabbling in this work, but they had not built a law firm. They were doing other stuff and a little bit of this. I said, this is who I'm going to help. I don't know how I'm going to do it, but I'm just going to start doing it and figure it out as I go. Right. And that's what I did. And I will tell you, Lisa, I did not get a behavioral health case for 14 months. Nobody knew who I was. I hadn't practiced law in 5 years. I hadn't lived in the state in 3 years. I was living in California, tripping the light, fantastic, you know, for 3 years and failing the California bar exam. It's all part of my journey. So I'm happy to talk about it. I've had a lot of missteps.
A lot of comebacks. Yeah.
Yeah. So I took responsibility and I made a conscious decision to build a business helping people. And I just was not going to take no for an answer. I couldn't take no for an answer. I was flat broke, and 11 months in, I lost my dad unexpectedly. So my life was a bit of a disaster. I maxed out every credit card I had to pay for a funeral. So, you know, things were insane around me, but you know, that was when I really found out what I had. And as you said, I took off the proverbial mask and I started to trust myself, and I was willing to make mistakes and learn from them. And I made a lot of mistakes along the way. I mean, there's a reason they call it the practice of law. The idea is as you do it more, you get better at it because you make more mistakes and you learn from them. But I also made mistakes in my business, and I made a lot of mistakes in my personal life. So my law partner, who's the Simovich, you can see back here, is my wife. And I met her in 2017, but I didn't marry her until 2.5 years ago. So that part of my life took a little bit longer to take 100% responsibility for. And again, I made a lot of mistakes along the way too.
Yeah. How we say it in here is, if your finger is pointed outward, like other focus, it's them. Take that finger and turn it inward. And that's where it begins for all of us, taking radical responsibility and accountability for what has happened in our life is where the real work begins. And that's when you start finding the miracles and stuff starts falling into place, but you got to keep at it. So Mark, thank you so much. I would love to have you back. Last question. What do you wish we were having more conversations about that we're not talking about?
So I think one of the things I've seen, Lisa, over the years is that we don't make quality treatment available to everybody. Yep. I mean, I make no bones about the fact that, you know, if you don't have health insurance or you don't have financial resources, having access to quality clinically appropriate treatment can be very challenging. And I think in a country like this, and I don't want to get political, because this has been my home for 40 years, I think is frankly a national disgrace. You've got to make our treatment available to everybody. And it shouldn't matter your financial background, your race, your religion, any of that stuff. Otherwise, this is just, as you said, it just spirals and snowballs.
Yeah, it does not get better. It only gets worse. Well, Mark, thank you so much. We're going to have you back next month. I want to hear more about your comeback story and the skills that you used to maneuver that. In the meantime, friends, those of you out there, ask yourselves, because what did Mark say? He took the mask off. And when he took the mask off, that's when everything started shifting. Observation is not neutral. Quantum physics, quantum mechanics tells us that the minute you observe it, it has already started to shift. So ask yourself today the question we always close out with: what are you performing in order to survive? And how might your life improve if you drop the role, mask, or performance? Mark, thank you so much. Friends, we'll see you at the edge next time. I'm your host, Lisa Lazy.